Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 319th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a trailblazer who is one of the American film industry's most respected producers and film festival chiefs. She is the co-founder, CEO, and executive chair of Tribeca Enterprises, a media company that encompasses Tribeca Productions, the Tribeca Film Festival, Tribeca Studios, and the Tribeca Film Institute. Her partner in all of this is one Robert De Niro, with whom she has run a production company since 1988 and with whom she has run the Tribeca Film Festival since 2002. Her credits include the TV movie The Wizard of Lies, for which she was Emmy-nominated in 2017, the TV limited series When They See Us, for which she was Emmy-nominated in 2019, won the Best Limited Series Critics' Choice Award in 2020, and is nominated for the PGA Award in that category this month, and a host of major films, including the Analyze This and Meet the Parents film franchises, and A Bronx Tale, About a Boy, Wag the Dog, and most recently, The Irishman, for which she was nominated for the Best Picture Critics' Choice Award and is nominated for both the top PGA Award and the Best Picture Oscar. She is not only one of the top producers, but also one of the most powerful women in entertainment, as has been noted on the Hollywood Reporter's Power 100 list, and with the New York Women in Film and Television Career Impact Achievement Award, Jane Rosenthal. Reuters has said, quote, "Movie producers do not turn into household names as often as actors and directors, but Jane Rosenthal leapt to that level," close quote. Over the course of our conversation at the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills, Rosenthal and I discussed how that happened, looking back at what led her to move to Hollywood after college and later to walk away from being a studio executive to partner with De Niro, how she and De Niro worked together and how they have navigated successes and failures, what it was about 9/11 that inspired them to start the Tribeca Film Festival in partnership with Rosenthal's then-husband Craig Hatkoff, why The Irishman took so long to get made but has made them so proud, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Jane, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you on the podcast. Always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Oh, my goodness. I was born in Aurora, rural Colorado. My father was actually in the Army, and I was an Army baby for a whole 10 days. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and moved to New York when I went to NYU.
Well, let's go back a second, though, because as a kid, the dream was not to be a producer, but it was to be in sort of the performing arts, right? What was the original hope?
At one point, I wanted to be an actress, but I didn't think I was really good. but I felt like I wanted to make a difference in the world, and I ended up being a page when I was 15, 16 in the Rhode Island House of Representatives, and really felt that if I went into politics, I could really make a difference in the
world. I think
you
were the first woman page, female page?
Yes.
Okay. There were a few of those along the way, first female,
And then I realized, okay, that the pages were actually making more money than the representatives were, and I didn't think that was right. It was also a period of time in the Rhode Island House, you had some interesting kind of deals, shady stuff like going on, but you know, you had really good Italian food. The speaker at the time, when it was his saint's day, would stop the business of the house, and all of his relatives would bring in all these Italian delicacies. So that was fun to witness.
This wasn't like Buddy Cianci days, was it?
This was like right around the time, but Buddy was mayor. This was the house.
Okay.
So I just really believed that if you could, whether it was telling documentary stories, which I had wanted to do, or film, you could have more impact to a certain extent than the politicians at the time.
So I believe it's 1975 that you moved to New York for the first time. What was the reason for that?
I was going to NYU, and I was going to be studying film in the film department. It wasn't a school at the time, really dating myself. But I was very excited because Martin Scorsese had been at NYU, and I would get to see his Sight and Sound films, and Haig Manoogian was running the department, and he was an extraordinary teacher, and he was also a great mentor to Marty.
So for you, at that time when you show up in New York, what would the ideal career have been going forward?
I don't think it was an ideal. It was just a matter of coming from... Look, you have to understand, Providence, Rhode Island was such an armpit at the time that I grew up there. So when going and being in New York and just seeing traffic, I would be like, oh my God, what's going on over there? What's going on over there? And you realize it's just there are more than three cars at a red light.
Right.
So everything to me was exhilarating. I wanted to do everything. I wanted to do theater. I wanted to study acting classes. I wanted to do journalism. I just couldn't get enough of it and didn't sleep very much. I mean, it was just going all the time. It was exhilarating. I felt like I had been asleep living, growing up in Providence for all these years. And finally, it was like, okay, New York.
Well, I think you had a few side hustles even while you were still a student. And actually, a couple of those sort of fatefully combined to sort of lead you out to LA. Can you share? Because this, I think a lot of people that listen to this podcast they're wondering if, you know, just what's the path to getting into this business? Sometimes I don't think it's replicatable. And this seems to be an example of just being in the right place, doing your job to the fullest, even when it was a sort of lowly position or positions. Anyway, take it away.
Well, my parents wouldn't put me through school if I majored in acting. And so I thought I'd major in film, which I did. And then it always seemed to be a lot of, I think, what drove me was the fact that my father said no a lot. And I wasn't really, I really needed to get a part-time job. So, because it would pay for as much as it cost to live in the dorm, and which still is there, the Weinstein dorm on University Place. I don't know many kids that really like being in that dorm now. Anyway, so I ended up working for CBS Sports as a researcher. It was also when CBS Sports was not a division, but was just a department. And it was before anybody could Google anything. And they had no research. And the first thing I was assigned to was the Pan Am Games. And ended up through the good graces of a writer by the name of Dan Jenkins and Pete Axelrod. They let me into the Sports Illustrated and Newsweek morgues so I could Xerox all the research.
Were you even a sports buff?
No. No, I wasn't a sports buff. But what was the human stories, the stories of what made somebody, why they were an athlete, what they had to endure, what they put themselves through. Those stories always interested me. What was also great about working for CBS was not only did I get a part-time job and got to be paid, but I also could use that as an independent study for my work at NYU through the Gallatin School. So whatever I was doing on the side, I was also making sure I got school credit for it. You know.
And then there's also something with the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas.
So I wanted to study. Lee Strasberg was still teaching at the Actors Studio occasionally. And there were these guys. One was Chris Walken. There was this other guy, Harvey Keitel. And there was this guy, Al Pacino. And sometimes this guy, Robert De Niro, would show up. And, you know, in order to observe sessions at the studio, you had to work. So I ended up getting involved. I was asked to read a play that was called The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and I ended up, quote, producing it, which meant I was really good at props and getting people's schedules
first
organized.
First producing credit.
Yes, and that play ended up moving from the studio to off-Broadway at the time. Stevie Phillips was an amazing theater producer and film producer who was working at Universal, had optioned the rights through her good friend Bill Goldman, who was also friends with Pete Masterson, which is how all of that came together. I wasn't involved. I was just really, you know, just carrying whatever they asked me to carry. So that was I was all of about 19 when that was going on. So to witness that and to just soak everything up was pretty amazing.
So if I have my information correct, it seems like the way the dots connect is that CBS people come in from LA, they want to go to the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. You have your moment to shine for them, right? Is that sort of correct?
God, you've done your homework, sir. I'm very impressed. Yes, that's actually what happened. Nobody could get tickets. And I, of course, had the house seat number, and the play did not get good reviews in New York papers, but it did get great reviews at a time where people were reading Time Magazine and Newsweek. So the national reviews were really, really good, and people read it, you know, on the plane coming in for programming, scheduling meetings, and everybody wanted tickets, and suddenly I was like, I can get you a ticket. So like, how can you get us a ticket, kid? And I was like, okay, well, and would explain this story.
Right. And so how does it come about that somebody says, come on out to L.A.?
Well, there was, I was about to finish school, and, you know, it was a time in the business where you were doing more. First of all, you only had four networks, and whenever there was programming failure, they would put on a television movie or a miniseries. It was in that post-Roots, rich man, poor man. I mean, I'm really going back into deep television history here. And, you know, they were also very mindful of what they were paying people and wanted some fresh new ideas. So having done Whorehouse and everything else, a gentleman by the name of Michael Severide offered me a job to do miniseries and television movies at CBS. And then it was a very difficult position of negotiating what I was now going to make working for CBS at the age of 21.
And in fact, that was relevant to your negotiations.
It was very relevant because they offered me like $18,000 or something, and I just remember saying, well, I have to at least make my age. So and they moved me, complete with my box spring mattress and orange cart and a few books.
Had you ever spent time in LA before moving there?
No.
So you show up and it's totally new.
Completely new.
And what did you make of it?
Well, the first thing that was really kind of disturbing is you couldn't hail a taxi. You had to drive everywhere.
Right.
And not that I didn't drive growing up in Providence, but what I always loved about New York is that you could just go out anywhere. It was that freedom. And it's that freedom that, you know, my kids now experience because the Uberfication of, you know, of the world.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was just to be able to go out and yell, taxi, always thinking I was Marlo Thomas or Mary Tyler Moore when I'd, like, race out in the street. And you couldn't do that in L.A., but I got used to it.
And so you were working at Television City? Or?
No, I was working at Radford.
Okay.
Studio City.
And
they just closed Dupar's, too. That was my favorite place to eat. Tuna melts. Did you ever have a Dupar's tuna melt?
I mean, for
your audience, I bet you'll get a lot of response. But it was a nippy nip tuna.
Well, so in between tuna sandwiches there, you did, I believe, 70-something TV movies. And this is over a period of maybe like 9 years?
No, it was a period of five years and acute programming failure. So when CBS would go from either being number two or number three. And at one point, there were four nights of movies on the air.
And so your responsibility was choosing material or producing these programs? What was
it? First of all, I had more no power. You know, it was not that I had yes power. I had no power. But it was about advocating for whatever project that was coming in to develop it, working with the writers, making sure writers' deals got done, advocating for it to go into production and overseeing the production. So I got to do everything from working with John Houseman and Henry Fonda on a movie about Clarence Earl Thomas called Gideon's Trumpet. Mm-hmm. And
they showed us that in a law class.
There you go. You know, so yeah. It was, okay, you're making a difference now. And it was a Hallmark Hall of Fame. I remember John Houseman coming in to meet me and like looking at me and saying, oh, I've just met this kindergarten person. And it was Faye Ray, David Rintel's, who wrote it. Faye Ray is David's mother-in-law, and he put Faye in it. So it was like Hollywood history. Right. It was absolutely amazing. I was also working for a man named William Self, who had produced a lot of Bogie and Bacall movies. It was just like, I couldn't believe where I was.
Well, yeah. I mean, within 5 years before, you were, you know, in school doing all this stuff on the side, and now you've got real responsibility.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah, eating yogurt on the train.
Well, so why did you leave CBS? I know you went to another good job, but how does that happen?
Well, I had covered every major social issue and disease of the week and hadn't found a cure for cancer. And, you know, I did movies at the time about The Gift of Life, about female Sarah, you know, about surrogate mother, which was considered like sci-fi. Susan Day was in it. It was really radical. And I fought to get the movie The Burning Bed made in CBS. Didn't want to make it. Then Brandon Tartikoff ended up making it at NBC, but I had developed that. I was a little frustrated. I was having to do a lot of stuff, which was extraordinary. It was amazing experience. But I wanted to focus. I wanted to be able to work on just a few projects at the same time. And was offered a job to go work with Frank Price at the time and go over to Universal Pictures.
And the job there was to do similar stuff?
Similar stuff, but on features. But it wasn't quite the way I thought it was going to be because Sidney Pollack was making Out of Africa. We got to see outtakes of it, which was exciting. Got to see some outtakes of the movie Brazil. And they had me working on Jaws. I don't remember the number. I don't
Three,
know.
Probably.
It was, they wanted me to do, because I had come out of television, they were really looking for me to do work on projects that had a sequel potential, and that really wasn't my forte. So I ended up moving to work with Katzenberg and Eisner when they had first moved from Paramount to Disney.
Yes.
And there I was doing both television movies, which were the Disney Sunday movies, as well as features. And it was there that I worked on the movie The Color of Money and got to know Scorsese, who said to me, "What are you doing as a studio executive? Why don't you, you should meet my friend Bob, who's thinking of starting a company.
A production company of his own." Now, just quick aside, this may be wrong, but was there ever at some point something with Warner Brothers Television?
That was a brief period after Disney and before I moved to New York.
So there was that gap because basically De Niro had been looking for a while for a partner. You also were not sure you were interested in uprooting your life and going back to the East Coast to go and work for an actor who the hell knew what you would be signing up for, right?
Correct.
So what tipped the scale when apparently a lot of people in your life were advising you against doing that?
Well, at the end of the day, I did this list of pros, cons, and intangibles. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the pros outweighed the cons, especially if I was going to trust my own instinct. Mm-hmm. And the intangibles were basically going to be intangibles for the rest of my life. And at the time, I was 29, and it was like, if I can't believe in myself, if I can't believe in my own instincts, then what can I believe in? And I mean, I'm not curing cancer. I'm in an industry that is about your instinct and about, and to a certain extent, it's like a startup. Every time you start a new movie, you're always starting from zero. So I thought, why not give it a try? The worst that was going to happen is I would come back to LA and be a studio executive.
Right.
It also didn't help that, or perhaps it did help, that I would have Bob calling me and saying things like, what is it? Do you want to be a studio executive for the rest of your life?
This is during the courtship.
Right. Do you want to be a studio executive for the rest of your life? And it just like still rings in my ears. I can hear him say that. And
well, so here we are almost 35 years.
No, it's late. Only 31. Well, let's not go 35.
31 since you started the production company.
Yes,
but
yes.
Since like, Color of Money when Scorsese.
Oh, God, yes.
So the reason I say this is you've had a long time to talk to both Scorsese and De Niro about, for Scorsese, what did he see in you that made him think you would work well with De Niro? And De Niro, why did he ultimately want to work with you over all these other people he'd been meeting with? Do you know what the answers to those questions are?
No. I mean, we joke about it a lot, and I think maybe Marty just didn't, you know, wanted to give Bob, oh, here's somebody, try this person, you know,
Because, I mean, you were, obviously, you'd packed a lot into 29 years, but you were a 29-year-old signing up to go work with already a legendary actor. It must have been kind of mind-blowing.
Well, yes, but it was nerve-wracking, too. We didn't have the name of a company. We were going to work in his kitchen. We didn't have an office. I didn't have an apartment. I mean, he wanted to, you know, I would tell people I'm moving to New York. I'm in Tribeca. They said, I thought you moved to New York. I did move to New York. It's above, you know, it's on the west side. It's below the Village. It's above the World Trade Center. You mean near New Jersey? I mean, there'd be this whole riff that would go on. And, you know, you just got tired and said, okay, I'm put my head down and just try to build this.
Well, let's talk about why you ended up in Tribeca, because I know that I think pretty early on in the production company partnership, you guys had a overhead deal with TriStar, and they're saying, we've got office space for you, but it's uptown. Why would you guys choose to be way downtown?
Well, that's Bob. Why would he want to do anything? Why would he want to do anything normal? Right. And what was in, you know, he lived downtown, and why would, you know, if we're going to, his goal with this, with that original overhead deal was, yes, I want to make movies. I want to find something that he could direct was a
priority.
Yeah. But could we do something? Could we capitalize on it? Could we do something and bring artists in New York together? Could we create kind of an open space community for artists? You see this now, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's like,
this
you
is
know,
WeWork before WeWork.
Without question, we were going to have shared office services, a common area. We blew out a ceiling so we could have double height ceilings.
This
and
is
an
the Tribeca
open.
Film Center.
This is the Tribeca Film Center. And the real estate people were furious, but we thought, okay, we have this great space with this amazing light, we're going to get uptown prices downtown if you could find Tribeca. And then Bob wanted to start a restaurant with his partner Drew Nipperant. And
so really at the end of the day, he just wanted to bring the industry closer to his home, right?
Yeah, within a little walking radius,
right.
You know.
So, okay, I've been fortunate both with you and separately on this podcast and other things to spend a little bit of time with Bob. And my sense is that he is a very reserved man of few words to most people. I think you probably see a different Bob than the rest of us. And so I wonder, what is he like when we're not around?
Well, it's like everybody else. You know, we talk about all kinds of things. It's like, you know, I've also been with Bob for so long. I don't, you know, there's a part of me that doesn't know anything else either. I mean,
but I mean, is what do you make of that? That he's obviously, he can be anybody on screen, but you know, in out in the world, it sometimes feels like he really closes up.
No, he's a passionate family man.
Yeah.
He's, you know, picks his, you know, daughter up from school. He is, you know, likes Sunday meals and watching movies, and he does, you know, just about what everybody else does. Rides his bike in New York. Yeah.
Well, so how does it work for you guys at the production company and what we'll get to later with the film festival and all of that, in terms of, you know, he's got he's always had a pretty active career as an actor as well. So are you basically the, you know, person who's there every day overseeing what needs to be overseen, and then you'll speak by phone, or how does it actually work in terms of co-running a operation with him?
Well, he will, if it's something that Bob is going to act in, if it's a project that Bob is going to act in, on the couple occasions that he directed both Bronx Tale and The Good Shepherd, and maybe there's another one in there, you know, it's a different working relationship than when we're just developing projects. But you're getting to a point that you want to develop what becomes what we're all passionate about. And as a production company, you know, it's not like you don't have to do a lot of volume, but you can do what you're passionate about.
And what if, you know, we gave you truth serum and you were to set aside all humility, what do you do best as a producer?
I really think I am absolutely dogged about putting projects together and steadfast and determined to get something made that I'm passionate about. And whether that takes months or inevitably years and years and years to do, I'll get it done. I think no is not an option for me with a lot of it.
And you've said, quote, for years and years, I was the only woman in the room, close quote. Things maybe are getting a little better. I'll leave that to you to say. But I just wonder, from that standpoint of things, what's your experience been?
There have been some wonderful days, and there have been some days I wish I had a stronger left hook. But I also learned what a good back alley was. It is now, you see, there's clearly more women in the room. And when you look at what, certainly I've been working with Netflix for the past couple of years, and Cindy Holland and Nina Tassler, and just that whole group has been extraordinary to work with. So you're definitely seeing more women. You're certainly, you know, we're starting to see more women directors. 2019 numbers were better than 2018 numbers, but change doesn't just happen because we want it to or because suddenly we have a movement. The fact that we're all woke to this is an advantage. I think it's also an advantage that we now have more than four places in the television universe, or even in, you know, the feature film universe, as both of these worlds are merging together anyway. But you have more places as a storyteller to tell stories. So that makes it better for all underserved and underrepresented communities.
So you mentioned that through the production company, you guys were able to give Bob his first opportunities to direct, and Bronx Tale continues to live on in other forms all these years later. But you also just mentioned female directors, and I can't help but wonder, have you ever been tempted to go to that side of things and direct?
I'm not interested in the cinema of Jane Rosenthal. So there was probably only one time that I've thought I could do a good job, but I think I'm way too ADD to just focus on something, although it could be a really, it could be relaxing. Yeah. I mean, in the ways that you're just focused on just one thing and right. have to shut the rest of the world out. I admire and in awe of directors and writers who can just, who do just shut the rest of the world out and go and do and create some extraordinary work.
Well, I want to ask you if you can just to give one kind of example of the ups and downs of being a producer. I want to bring up a period of maybe 3 years of releases and ask you to just take us through your what was going on in your head through this. So 1997, out comes Wag the Dog, a movie you guys produced. Great movie, still referenced this month, in fact, with
today
even with our wonderful president, sarcastically said. So that comes out in 97. 99, Analyze This, is the sort of the start of Bob's comedy reinvention and a whole franchise. And then 2000, you've talked about this before as, I guess, a life lesson, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, which was not successful in by most traditional metrics. And then right after that, though, the rebound of a huge success with Meet the Parents, which launched another franchise and really, again, reinforced that Bob can do comedy tremendously. So that's within a period of, again, like 3-4 years, a lot of ups and downs. I think it illustrates how many projects you have in the air at one point. Can you just maybe reflect on that for a minute, any when you think back to that time?
And I had two babies.
And two babies.
And I had two babies. You never know what it is being called in to have a rewrite meeting on the eve of when you're starting to shoot and you've had a baby 10 days ago and your milk is coming in and you're like, okay. And it's not like every place they have today are nursing stations. I'm so envious when I see those, although I'm certainly not envious of, anyway, never mind. So you learn much more from your failures than you do from your successes. I really believed in Rocky and Bullwinkle and what that could have been. It was, you know, nobody hits a home run all the time. You've singles, you have ground balls, and sometimes you just completely strike out. But that's what trusting your instinct is. And, you know, it was from a CG standpoint, we were doing 2.5D, and the combination of what we were doing with live action and animation was actually groundbreaking at the time, but it didn't work. You know, you don't lose sleep
over
it.
You don't stay down.
I remember more of the detail of that than I remember some of the other stuff because it became so personal. Success has so many, you know, so many fathers,
yes.
and failure has but one. Okay, all of a sudden it was me, 100%. So you know, I take that. You know, I'll take that.
There haven't been too many.
But it was you know, working on Meet the Parents and with Jay Roach and Ben Stiller and John Hamburg, and that whole team became a real family, and you know, still close to all those guys and Blythe Danner. And look, then the spring of 2001, mm-hmm. I was doing About a Boy in London, and I was doing a movie called Showtime with Bob and Eddie Murphy here in L.A. And I was going L.A., New York, London, London, New York, L.A. I had little babies. I was picking up a kid and bringing them and traveling and just back and forth and back and forth. And I was I dropped my daughter off at school in second grade, my daughter Juliana, who's now 25, off at school, and racing to a staff meeting because I had to leave on September 12th. 2001 to come to LA for a screening of Showtime, and that was like get into the office, go, and 9/11 happened, and my car stopped on a yellow light a block and a half south of the towers on West Street, and you know what, everything like changed completely. I mean, I know I sound, it was everything changed. It was like, okay, a research screening in LA, I can't go. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. What does it mean if I show up? I can't get to London to see another cut of about a boy. Can I get to my kid? Can I get out of here? That changed a lot of people's lives. You know, from a very insular, just talking about me, it was deeply affecting. And it was, and I went for days about how come I ran out. I ran out and you had all these firefighters and police and rescue workers running in. And what is that instinct to who runs out and who runs in? And the guilt of that, of who decides to save that stranger next to you, that how do you, what is that in your life? What happens when you're stuck in those God-foreseen circumstances? And that's when, like right after that, we started doing these dinner downtowns. I just, like, how do we do something for our community? How do we do something for the rescue workers, the firefighters, the police? How do we do something for our neighbors so that we know who our neighbors are? And then by November 2001, we announced we were doing Tribeca Film Festival.
That's amazing. And I think that, you know, just to kind of, if anyone doesn't know this history of what you guys did there, it was, you sort of referenced it, but can you explain how quiet and depleted and whatever lower Manhattan and Tribeca was? I mean, your guys' offices, from what I understand, basically looked at ground zero.
Yeah. Well, we looked at the towers. You didn't look at...
Yeah.
Well, you know, you were breathing black smoke. There was definitely an uptown-downtown divide. People were afraid to come downtown. You had to show your... There were tanks and, you know, military with rifles and helicopters going. It was a war zone, period. It was a war zone. You couldn't get into the area for a long time, even before the Red Cross came in. You had volunteers that were bringing tube socks, and the restaurants, Drew Nipperant, Marty Shapiro from the Tribeca Grill, Daniel Boulay. There were a number of restaurant workers who went into the area to bring in hot food. No one could get there. And that's in the middle of New York City.
Right.
You know? So it was,
well,
it was scary.
Comes back to what you're saying. You know, you're in New York when you've got all this action, taxis and everything. That was not happening. So just one follow-up about that. You guys, just to be totally clear for anyone listening, so it's you, your then husband, and Bob start this film festival. Had any of you ever had anything to do? I mean, I know there'd been some discussion pre 9/11, maybe one day let's do a film festival or whatever, but now you're doing it. How do you know how to even start to do it, to run a film festival, let alone turn it around in essentially four months you had to get it to going?
Days, yeah. Well, ignorance is bliss. You don't quit your day job and start a film festival. And I have said the world didn't need another film festival at the time, but Tribeca did. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that we were doing it once. I also thought, because we announced it November 2001, and I thought, okay, if I can prep a movie in 3 months, I can prep a film festival. I didn't think about sponsorships. I didn't think about submissions. I didn't think about a lot of things. None of us did. I remember Bob coming in and saying, because we were trying to get Star Wars, and Bob saying, okay, he spoke to Lucas, and if the festival were the following week, we could get Star Wars. And I just said, okay, so we'll change the date of the festival. Nobody's waiting for us. Dating becomes a big thing now that people complain about the date of our festival.
And so you guys did end up, you had your own movie about a boy. You had Attack of the Clones, which, I mean, every time a Star Wars movie comes out, that's a huge deal. And it, I mean, here we are. This is going to, the 2020 version is going to be the 19th?
Now, this is our 19th festival coming up.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, what I want to obviously close with is The Irishman, which today is one of many days at this time of year this year when you are being honored for either The Irishman or When They See Us, which is another project that you've produced. In fact, today I believe is both you're nominated for. Let's focus on The Irishman, though. I mean, this was one where you've said that Casino came out in 95, and basically from that point, it's, you know, there had been a steady clip up to that point of Bob and Marty making movies together. So, all right, let's find the next one. And it took quite a while to find one. Then you guys find one with the book, I Heard You Paint Houses. That's back in 2007. So can you please connect the dots for how, you know, why this was as sort of epic a journey as it's been?
Well, nobody wanted to make it.
Why, though? This is De Niro and Scorsese and Rosenthal?
But it's De Niro and Scorsese, and if De Niro and Scorsese and Pesci and Pacino with a Steve Zaillian script have a brand in this brand-conscious world that we're in, and the sequel-itis, this was that. But people were afraid of it. And
why?
What the technology would be, would you go... and by the way, you didn't have a certain type of technology at that point. It wasn't until Pablo Hellman was working with Marty on Silence and thought that he could have a more intuitive way for the actors to work without balls and, you know, strange objects all around them.
For the reverse aging, yeah.
For the reverse aging. So, look, there were times where you could have gotten it made by, you know, splitting rights and, you know, which we did, and then that was untangled. You could have done it for a very specific lower budget number, but, you know, by the time we got there, if you're going to do something with Bob and Marty, then it should be their vision and it should be done the way they want it. And I guess we waited for the industry to change, and Netflix came along. They were just done Roma a year ago. And
that impressed you, the way they handled that?
Without question. You think about a black and white Spanish-speaking movie with no stars. Okay, maybe they could work with, you know, they could work with us. And we called Ted and met with Ted, and he read it, said, I want to do this.
So as people who overcame any reservations you may have had about Netflix or going a non-traditional distribution model, what would you say to people who today still have sort of their guard is up when they hear Netflix, whether it's Academy members or whoever? Why should they reconsider Netflix?
Well, first of all, Netflix did give us we're still in theaters.
Yes.
So the fact that you are in theaters and on platform are not mutually exclusive. Our audiences want choices, just like they want a choice to listen to a podcast versus read, you know, versus reading. It doesn't mean that by not reading a particular magazine or newspaper, they're not going to also listen to the podcast. Mm-hmm. So we have choices as audiences, and that's the key. The other thing is that as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you want your film to be seen by the widest possible audience. More people will end up seeing Irishman than probably any Scorsese De Niro movie combined. That's pretty extraordinary for people to be able to, a global audience to be able to see that work, that these, you know, titans, icons of cinema
created.
They can,
or whatever.
Right. So that right there is, you know, that right there is a plus for all of us, no matter what community we're from. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't see things in cinema. But by the way, theaters are shrinking. Netflix bought The Paris, which was just a couple months ago. But prior to that, we've lost the Ziegfeld. It's a an event space.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like the Hyatt. By the way, the Hyatt can look very nice, but you're
Lincoln
looking
Plaza.
At you, it's yeah. all they're gone, mm-hmm. and the seats are so you're they're more interested in hospitality and and entertaining in the space versus the quality of the screen. Now that's I'm sure I'm wrong that there is there are some places that are for the quality of the screen, but that's not a large number. So the great thing about Netflix is you can have screen quality and distribution in theater, and then you can also watch it on whatever platform you want. And I don't know, my screen at home is
pretty good.
Is pretty good. So
last question. This is an interesting moment in a lot of ways. Obviously, Irishman's gone over tremendously, and I've never seen Bob do as much to sort of celebrate and support a movie as he's done here. He's just been amazing everywhere. He's obviously very proud of it. I would think, I'm sure you are as well. At the same time, things are kind of evolving with Tribeca. I know you guys have just had a new partner come along in James Murdoch. I guess I just wonder, give us your outlook here at the beginning of 2020 about where all these many facets of your life stand and how you feel about it.
I'm exhilarated. First of all, I feel like I'm in a state of relief and disbelief that one got The Irishman made. It is the vision that Marty had always had, and that it is it has been embraced by people, and to have at this point in their lives, and and listening to what we talked about earlier, to be able to be part of that and to have produced this with Emma has been a career highlight. If I don't do another movie, this is like, this is pretty extraordinary. Mm. That's not to say that
you're not quitting anytime soon.
No, I'm not quitting anytime soon. And in terms of Tribeca Enterprises and our new partnership with James and Attention Capital, Joe Marchese, it's exhilarating because we're allowing us to really grow the festival the way we need to grow it. It's difficult to do a festival in the middle of New York City. We have been doing it for a while, but as the industry is changing and the way you tell stories and how you tell stories and the new creators that are coming into that are in the world and to be able to curate and showcase those stories, whether they're amazing great game creators or it's the work that we do in immersive storytelling or it's what's being done online with short storytelling, it's just an exciting time to be able to curate and showcase that work, and how we'll expand it from here is it's just exciting times for us.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Congratulations. And
thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporters Podcast Network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.